From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We start the hour on the West Coast, where wildfires continue to engulf large portions of Oregon, Washington, and California. The smoke billowing into the atmosphere can be seen from space.
The fires have also claimed dozens of lives and destroyed nearly 5 million acres. And to put that figure in perspective, that's almost the entire state of New Jersey. For the latest, let's bring in Monica Samayoa. She's an environmental reporter for Oregon Public Broadcasting. And Monica, give us a sense of where you are, what the air is like and what the sky is like today.
So I'm located in Portland, and today the sky is still foggy and very gloomy. The smoke is still very heavy in my area. The air quality index is currently reading 477. That's hazardous. I have my doors and my windows sealed as tight as I can, but I still get those big whiffs of smoke in my home.
There is a front off the coast that's hopefully going to blow some moist air in that could clear some of this smoke. But I'm thinking about firefighters. This means that the winds could now blow the fires in a totally different direction. I mean, what conditions are firefighters looking at this week?
Well, thankfully, we do have that moisture this week. We are supposed to have rain tomorrow and Wednesday, and that's really going to help firefighters fight those larger fires we are seeing across the west side of the state. Smoke has kept temperatures down, which are in the 50s, and further raised humidity. Last week during a press conference, fire officials did say these larger fires will continue to burn through at least the end of summer and well into those fall rains. If the weather changes, the situation could change, but this means that we can begin to get those containment lines set in and start to control and contain the fires. So it's a glimmer of hope.
We're starting to hear some really harrowing stories coming out of Oregon. A man who was speaking to his wife without realizing it was her. She was so badly burned. Entire towns, like a place called Detroit, Oregon, razed. Have you ever seen anything like this before?
I'm from California, so I was living in California when Camp Fire hit Paradise, and these fires are burning through these areas so quickly, it's not giving anyone any time to escape them. And, you know, those are just a few fires. We've had a number of large fires that start and spread rapidly, burning an entire fire season's worth of land in just a few days. For example, Oregon's already over 1 million acres burned, and we have 34 active fires in the state, and a lot of them are still, you know, less than 10%, 5% containment. So that's why fire officials here are asking people to follow evacuation orders so we can avoid any more deaths.
There are also other challenges that first responders are dealing with. We're reading about 911 dispatchers who say they're inundated with calls from people who are actually calling in or asking for more information on false claims that the fires were started by arsonists or Antifa members. Police are begging people to stop dialing 911 call centers with this lie. Do we have any real information yet about what might have started these blazes?
Yeah, so when I was out in these same areas, this is Clackamas County, which is it's the next county next to Portland. I was out there on Wednesday, and one of the first things people were asking me about was if Antifa was starting fires. That was definitely a first for me. There was one fire that I know near the coast of Oregon that was due to arson, and that person was arrested a day or two after those fires were started, and they have been contained. I do know that most of the larger fires that we're seeing are due to the same lightning storm that California saw. And on top of that, we also had east winds that were blowing in close to 60 miles an hour for about 4 days last week, from Monday through Thursday. And on top of that, we had warm temperatures. So we just had a combination of really bad weather last week. And, you know, that's why this week with the moisture coming in, that is just great news.
Does Oregon have enough manpower right now to fight these fires?
There's definitely not enough. Many firefighters arrived too late. A week ago, Oregon Governor Kate Brown put out a request for firefighters from other states, but only Utah responded. Although we've gained 1,000 crew members since then, it's nowhere near the 6,000 members Brown has asked for. I do know there are at least 4,000 firefighters throughout the whole state, but we need more to continue to fight these fires and also give firefighters that have been working, 36 hours straight, a break before anything tragic happens of being overworked.
Mm-hmm. That's Monica Samayoa, environmental reporter for Oregon Public Broadcasting. Thank you so much and stay safe.
Thank you.
We are now 7 weeks away from Election Day in a very unusual presidential campaign. But one thing is for sure, many Americans will, as they often do, vote on economic issues. President Trump had this to say at that rally in Nevada over the weekend.
We will rapidly return to full employment, soaring economies, and record prosperity. We will expand opportunity zones, and we will continue cutting taxes and regulations at a level that nobody has ever seen before.
Former Vice President Joe Biden spoke about his tax plan on ABC News last month.
I will raise taxes for anybody making over $400,000. Let me tell you why I'm going to do it. It's about time they start paying a fair share of the economic responsibility we have. The very wealthy should pay a fair share.
Let's talk tax plans with Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic, who joins us from Washington, as he does each Monday. Derek, let's start with President Trump. We heard him there promise more tax cuts. We remember the president's more than $1 trillion tax cuts back in 2018, which have ballooned the deficit and did not pay for themselves as promised. What is the president promising this time when it comes to taxes?
So I think it's very important to make clear that President Trump's corporate income tax plan was, or tax law, was the singular legislative achievement of his first term. It did cut taxes for many families. It slashed long-term rates on corporate income. That was a huge and very real law. What he's talking about now on the campaign trail is not huge, and it's not necessarily real either. It's not clear, indeed, that the GOP has any firm tax plans for a second Trump term beyond protecting the corporate income tax law that was passed several years ago. In fact, famously, the Republican platform published before the RNC took place famously had no policies attached to it. So, yes, it is the case that Trump is, going around and he's using the words tax and plan in sentences on the campaign trail. But I don't consider those utterances to be literal tax plans. The plan is to protect what is already law.
Mm-hmm. And we remember, of course, that the tax plan that he did make into a law was done with the help of both a Republican House and a Republican Senate. And he does not currently have a Republican controlled House of Representatives. The president also has been talking about opportunity zones. We heard that a couple of minutes ago, a tax break for investors who invest in certain low income communities. The program has had mixed results. What is the president saying about opportunity zones?
Again, he's talking about protecting opportunity zones. He's talking about expanding them, but it's not entirely clear, as you just said, that there's going to be much enthusiasm for expanding Republican tax plans if Democrats keep the House, which is very likely no matter what happens with the White House and the Senate. Opportunity zones are interesting. It's a way to funnel money to lower income areas that are designated by the government so that they are they get essentially capital gains tax breaks over the next decade. It's a fine idea. I think it's way too early to tell if it's working. But geographic inequality is a thorny problem, and it is an important arrow that belongs in the quiver.
We heard Vice President Biden talking about raising taxes on people making more than $400,000 a year. What do we know about his tax plan?
There are a lot of little details in Joe Biden's tax plan. Unlike the Republican platform before the RNC, there are a lot of line items in Biden's tax plan. It basically comes down to this. Biden's plan would raise taxes on people earning more than $400,000, as he said in that clip that you just played, and it would increase the top corporate tax rate from 21% to 28%. That's a little bit lower than where it was before Trump cut it. Again, I think it's important to talk about the Senate and the House, as you did under Trump. The same way that Trump is not necessarily going to be able to get anything done if he doesn't have a Democratic House, if Democrats win the White House but don't take the Senate, I don't quite see how they're going to be able to pass tax increases on families making more than $400,000. So there's a lot in there, but going from idea to law is contingent upon Democrats winning the Senate, which is far from certain at this point.
There's a lot of uncertainty, but one thing we do know is it's going to be a tough economy, whoever comes in January. What do we know about what kind of economy the next president or the current president, if he gets another term, will inherit?
Well, so I think at the beginning of this recovery, there was a lot of debate about what the letter of the recovery was going to be. Was it going to be a slow U-shaped recovery, a sharp V-shaped recovery, an L recovery where there really is no swing back? And the letter that economists seem to have settled on is K, a sharp recovery for the haves, especially those who can work remotely, and a really, really difficult economy for everybody else. So I think that what's the next few months are contingent on whether or not we see a decline in the number of COVID cases in the U.S. You're going to be able to have restaurants and maybe even movie theaters start to come back if you break outbreaks in certain areas. But as long as there's still a live outbreak, it's hard to see things going back to normal.
Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Wednesday, September 16th from 9 to 10 a.m. sdm.mit.edu.
Let's look into the future for a minute. Let's say there is a safe and effective vaccine for COVID-19 that is ready for use this year. How will it get to everyone who needs it? Joining us now is Dr. William Moss, who's executive director of the International Vaccine Access Center at the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Moss, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, and let's say that it's an American company like Moderna that develops the vaccine first and it's approved by the FDA. What happens next to first manufacture enough of it and then distribute it?
Yes. So there are two broad issues here. One is how we can scale up manufacturing and the logistics of distributing a vaccine. And the second large issue that we'll need to wrestle with is how to prioritize who will first get a vaccine. So in terms of the distribution side, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is really the leading institution in the United States and of the government that will oversee the distribution of a COVID-19 vaccine. They've contracted to McKesson Corporation, which is a company that has a lot of experience in distributing vaccines. They distribute about 150 million doses per year. And McKesson will work with the CDC to distribute a vaccine to all the different places that need it within the United States. This is going to include public health departments, large healthcare organizations, hospitals, doctor's offices, and pharmacies. What's going to be really critical is that we can do this quickly and maintain what is called the cold chain. The cold chain is something that's a key part of vaccine distribution. Almost all vaccines need to be kept cold. And some of our newer vaccines, like you mentioned the Moderna vaccine, which is a messenger RNA vaccine, are going to have particularly stringent cold chain requirements. They may even require storage of the vaccine at much lower temperatures than we do for standard vaccines.
Well, and the other thing is you're talking about distributing it through the United States. If the United States, if a company in the United States develops a vaccine, I imagine that, you know, France, Germany, countries all across the world are going to be wanting it too.
Yes, and that's a really important question. How will a vaccine manufactured in the United States, will it be available to people around the world in countries in Europe, for example? But there's also concern about getting a vaccine to some of the lower and middle income countries, let's say throughout sub-Saharan Africa and Asia. And right now, it's not entirely clear how that process is going to work. My own sense is that a vaccine manufactured in the United States will probably be prioritized for people within the United States. Unfortunately, the current administration has is cutting ties with the World Health Organization and particularly a program called COVAX, which is led by the World Health Organization, Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, and CEPI, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness and Innovation, that are coordinating efforts to ensure equitable distribution of a vaccine around the world. So it's not yet clear how a vaccine manufactured in the United States would be prioritized within the United States and then outside the United States.
Well, and on the flip side, what if the vaccine gets developed in China or Israel? Then would the United States be second or even later down the list in terms of access to that vaccine?
I think so. That's a very important question. But and there are efforts to try to avoid vaccine nationalism, where countries that develop a vaccine are using it only in their own country. And it's going to be a very tricky political decision to determine how vaccines will be allocated within the country and then shared more globally. Again, I think countries will probably prioritize at least some of the high priority groups within their own country. This may be healthcare workers, essential workers, those vulnerable populations like the elderly or people with comorbid conditions that make them at particular high risk for both disease and death. I think those people will probably be prioritized within the country, but we definitely need an ongoing conversation and plan about how to ensure that as vaccines manufacturing is scaled up, they'll actually get to the people who need them.
You talked about McKesson and having experience getting vaccines to tens of millions of people, but have we ever seen anything like this where a similar situation where you have a disease that is all over the world and just about everybody is going to want access to this vaccine?
Right. This really, in many ways, is an unprecedented situation. The most similar situation, I will say, at least in recent history, was the 2009 H1N1 influenza pandemic, where there was concern about widespread transmission of influenza virus and the potential for a lot of mortality. That would be the most recent example where there was this kind of global need for a vaccine. But that didn't pan out, fortunately. We didn't see the deaths that we're seeing now with COVID-19 and the widespread transmission of SARS coronavirus 2. So I think we're really in new territory here. The other thing that makes the H1N1 influenza pandemic different is that we had a lot of experience with influenza vaccines. People knew about them. We knew what they were. Here, we're trying to develop new vaccines to a new virus. Mm-hmm. And some of the vaccine platforms or the way these vaccines are being manufactured is quite different than ways that we've done so in the past. We talked about the Moderna vaccine, a messenger RNA vaccine. That's a really new type of vaccine. Some of the other leading vaccine candidates are adenovirus vector vaccines, where the gene of the spike protein of SARS coronavirus is inserted into an adenovirus that's then administered. That, too, is a relatively new vaccine. It's been approved just this year in July for Ebola, but we have this problem of, or challenge, I'll say, of new vaccine types, multiple different vaccines being manufactured in several countries, and the challenge of getting this to a global population. I hope you're right, Jeremy, that most people will want this vaccine, but that too is a big concern. And recent polls in the United States suggest that only perhaps half of people would be willing to get a vaccine.
Would somebody who gets a vaccine, though, be in danger because of the person who doesn't get a vaccine?
Well, hopefully not. Hopefully that a person who gets the vaccine will develop protective immunity that will last for a long time. But both of those are still uncertain. There's been talk about what would be an acceptable vaccine effectiveness. And we've set the bar relatively low. People are talking about a vaccine that maybe protects only half the people who get the vaccine, or 75% of people who get the vaccine. We also do not know yet how long this protection will last after vaccination. So with an ideal vaccine that offers protection to almost everyone who gets the vaccine and that has durable immunity, then such people who are vaccinated would not need to worry. But if only half of those people are protected and that protection is short-lived, yes, then they would need to worry about those who do not get the vaccine, because those are the people who could transmit the virus to both vaccinated and unvaccinated individuals.
Let me ask you one more thing, because businesses, large and small, as well as schools, of course, are trying to figure out what to do. When can people come back to the office? And obviously, at this point in time, there's a risk in allowing workers or asking workers to come back in. And then, you know, what if one of them gets coronavirus? Who's on the hook for that? So let's pretend, best case scenario, there's a vaccine that comes out by the end of this year. How long do you think it will take until that is widely available enough where companies can say to their workers, okay, come on back?
Right. This timeline for when a vaccine will be available and when it will be available to the general public is an important timeline, but there's still a fair amount of uncertainty about that. There's no doubt that early on, there will not be sufficient quantity of vaccine doses to vaccinate everyone who wants to get vaccinated. And there's a lot of thinking right now by a number of expert groups trying to think about who should be prioritized. But my own guess would be that it won't be until mid or late 2021 that we'll have a vaccine available to the general public so that employers, for example, could require that their employees get a vaccine. I think we're going to need to prioritize, and that's probably going to be, as we said earlier, healthcare workers, essential workers, those who are most vulnerable. And then slowly, as vaccine manufacturing capacity increases, make the vaccine available to a wider public.
That is Dr. William Moss, who is the executive director of the International Vaccine Access Center at the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Moss, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And we'd like to hear from you. Will you get a COVID-19 vaccine as soon as it's available? Let us know at hereandnow.org. And by the way, would you go back to work in the office if that's what you were doing before if you didn't have a vaccine? Hereandnow.org. The Gulf Coast is bracing for another hurricane. The National Hurricane Center says Sally, which was a tropical storm, has strengthened into a Category 1 hurricane. Sally has already been dumping rain on Florida and is likely to strengthen as it heads toward the Louisiana coast and New Orleans. Joining us now is Jeff Huffman, director and chief meteorologist at the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Jeff, where is Sally now and what's its track and timing for landfall?
Good afternoon, Jeremy. Sally is, of course, as you mentioned, now a hurricane. It's about due south of Pensacola, and it's moving slowly to the west, west-northwest, and expected to continue strengthening. It underwent a rapid intensification cycle this morning. Winds are now gusting well into hurricane force. It's expected to potentially come close to a Category 2 before landfall, and that landfall track has shifted slightly to the east because this morning, Jeremy, the center reformed a bit to the east as well, which that tends to happen sometimes when storms undergo rapid intensification. So landfall is now projected to be somewhere along the southeast coast of Louisiana, southern coast of Mississippi and Alabama, sometime Tuesday afternoon to Tuesday night. Emphasis on the word slow. It's a very slow-moving system, of course, which will enhance the potential for flooding. That's going to be the big story, I think, with now Hurricane Sally.
Well, and Louisiana's Governor John Bel Edwards has already declared a state of emergency for Louisiana, which is still dealing with the damage from Hurricane Laura that made landfall there just 3 weeks ago with 150 mile per hour winds. Some people still don't have power. Sounds like Sally is not going to be as bad as Laura.
In terms of the widespread wind damage, likely not. But remember, every hurricane or every tropical system, not just hurricanes, are very unique and pose their own hazards. This one is a slow-moving system. It's going to produce a prolonged period of life-threatening storm surge, pretty much from the mouth of the Mississippi River all the way over to maybe Pensacola. And then because the storm is going to be in the vicinity of the northern Gulf Coast states for two, maybe 3 days, we're talking maybe Wednesday or Thursday before it pulls up into the southern Appalachians. Very heavy rain, inland flooding, freshwater flooding, flash flooding. We're talking about a 2 to 3 day event here that could produce rain totals in the order of 10 to 20 inches near and east of where the center tracks.
I'm looking at the National Hurricane Center website right now, and there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 systems out there. Not all of them have become even tropical storms yet, but this is a pretty busy season.
Yeah, when it comes to records, where do you begin? I mean, right now we have 5 tropical cyclones or named storms. That is tied for the record at the same time. If we get 6, it would break the record. And we're now only one name away from having to move into the Greek alphabet. This is certainly what they call a hyperactive season, and we have broken, I think, I'm losing count, but somewhere over 13 or 14 records in terms of the earliest a particular named storm forms. The numbers keep falling. I mean, we've had fairly weak systems other than Laura, and Sally is, of course, a significant threat to the northern Gulf Coast states. But, for example, in Florida, we've missed most of the storms in Florida, and there's still a potential. We still have several more weeks of the peak of hurricane season to go.
That is Jeff Huffman, Director and Chief Meteorologist at the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network, as we keep an eye on Sally, which, as we said, is now a hurricane heading toward the Louisiana coast. Jeff, thanks as always.
All right, thank you.
Last week, Minnesota Public Radio fired its only Black classical music host for changing up the station's classical music lineup without permission. Garrett McQueen defends what he did, saying he mixed in works by Black composers and added more contemporary music to reflect the moment we're in. McQueen's actions are just the latest in an ongoing movement calling for more diversity in classical music. Conductor Brandon Keith Brown argues that classical music can change the racial conscience of society, and he recently penned a Medium article titled, "It's Time to Make Orchestras Great Again by Making Them Blacker." Brandon Keith Brown joins us now from Berlin, Germany. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
So, Brandon, you say the concert hall is a magical place, and yet at every level you write, concert halls make it clear that they are for white people only. You're a conductor. Explain what this looks and feels like for you.
Well, even as an audience member, when I go to the hall, you know, people are always staring. There's this over attention on you because you're one of the only Black people, if not the only Black person in the concert hall. And typically these spaces, these orchestra spaces or opera spaces, have historically been spaces for white people to separate themselves, typically bourgeois, upper middle class white people, to separate themselves from people of lower class and people that are different than them. Mm-hmm. So even though this is my music, I own this music, I conduct this music, this is my profession, there is always still even that sense of not belonging when you go. And it also sometimes can follow me very much on the podium when I'm conducting an orchestra as well.
Hmm. In your latest piece, though, you say worldwide orchestra seasons continue to shrink. And this economic fallout with COVID-19 is indication that white musicians playing music by white composers for white-only audiences isn't sustainable. But to the point you just made, hasn't classical music always been classist or elitist? What you seem to be saying is that it's time to rethink this.
Well, I will say that every time you've given Black people access to an art form, athletics, we have dominated. And because classical music is a space of white supremacy designed for and by white people only, I think one of the biggest fears white people have is that blacks will come in and dominate this space and take away this space from them. And so I think that's why we see orchestras are only 1.3% black in the United States. We don't see black soloists that are able, and it's not because we're not able to do it. It's not because we're not able to be music director of a top five orchestra, which has never happened. It's not because we're not ready to do it. It's because they want to keep these spaces white. And this woke me up, to put it very frankly, to the fact that I'm black before I'm a conductor. You know, I will never be seen as a, you know, orchestra conductor before I am black.
I want to talk with you a little bit about the music itself, and the music appealing to larger audiences. So ballet and theater seems to have evolved in ways that classical music has not. So is this also a challenge, not just getting more people of color and black people specifically into classical music and attending performances, but also evolving the medium?
Very much so. Look, I've used several times in my articles Beyoncé. So Beyoncé has no problems getting an audience. But when you ask yourself, who is the typical Beyoncé audience member? It's all different colors, shapes and sizes. Ballet has come along quite a bit, I believe, in the sort of the evolution, because all of the classical, really all of the classical art forms were imported. A lot of them were imported from Europe. But because blacks have had access to a lot of other dance forms, I believe that we've started to be included. But classical music banks on actually secluding itself and dividing society by race and class. And you'll hear a lot in orchestras advertising, you know, basically, we're playing Beethoven. It's really great. It's good for you. Come hear it. But there's no offer of exchanging cultures, no sort of meeting people in the middle and saying, this is really great what you're doing. We're going to include what your cultural repertoire is. We're going to include your cultural repertoire with what we do. Instead of just saying, we're playing in this hall, you should come in. And if you don't, you're low class, you're less educated, you're not sophisticated. And so I do speak a lot on the racial aspect, but you've got to realize that classical music is saying no to the working poor. If you look at 2016, 2% of American society went to the opera.
But you know what? There are glimpses of classical music in popular culture. I mean, I'm thinking about how my son is always sitting around and humming the theme to Revenge of the Sith by John Williams. But there isn't necessarily the connection with the classical music world. And so, and that's how most people experience classical music today. Those who aren't part of the 1% who go to the music halls, they experience it through movies and shows. How do you drive that connection?
Well, first of all, I believe that's my fault, and that's the fault of classical music. You can't have this sort of elitist art form and expect people to come to you. You have to come to them. One of the major disconnects between orchestras and opera companies in cities is that we're not addressing the needs of people. So classical music has utility in the movies, right? Classical music has a certain type of utility for dance because music is moving the body. But when we talk about classical music in a concert hall setting, for many people, it doesn't have a real utility. But this connection is my responsibility as a conductor, is to somehow reach across lines and class of race and get people in a room to be able to feel the same thing at one time. So if we can remind people that we're all human and we have the same feelings through sound, if we could do it through this way, I think that we can, this is something, the shared empathy that will go out into the street. This is something that is going to, you know, allow us to sit next to each other in the train without, you know, white people getting up when I sit down. You know, people won't grab their purse when I pass by and switch it to the other side. People won't cross the other side of the street. People won't call the police on me when I'm in the grocery store and, you know, think I put something in my pocket. And maybe the police will stop shooting us. You know, Pierre Bourdieu, the famous sociologist and philosopher, said that music is the only art form that goes directly to the human spirit. And this is one of the reasons why I believe that only classical music can save itself, but I believe classical music is the only thing that can change the racial conscience of white society in America, because it polarizes society in such a strong way. I can't think of anything else that can bring balance to this.
Hmm. Before we let you go, there is some music that really speaks to this that you're talking about, that you listen to get through hard times. Mendelssohn's Calm Seas and Prosperous Voyage, first performed in Berlin in 1828. Here are the opening measures from a performance you conducted recently at the Cape Town Philharmonic. Brandon, what about this resonates with you?
This is a prayer for hope. You know, this is a prayer for a time of peace. And it's, you know, this music is really important right now to give us a vision. The fact is, we don't know when peace will come. We don't know when peace will come for COVID. We don't know when this social unrest will stop. But this is, I think, for me right now, this is one of the only pieces that gives me this, a calm and a sense that eventually things will be better. You know, I mean, things, of course, are not going to go back to normal. It'll be forever changed. But I think that we can say definitely something will be better.
Brandon Keith Brown is a classical music conductor in Berlin, Germany. Brandon, thank you so much for talking about this topic with us.
Thank you for having me.
It's Here and Now.
Back now to our top story. Tens of thousands of people have been forced to evacuate their homes, and at least 35 have died as wildfires tear across the West. Many of the firefighters trying to put out the flames are volunteers. Jeff Bellier is a fire chief in California's Napa County.
We need more resources because the fires are bigger, and we have to be able to draw on all the varying levels of the fire service to help put these fires out as quickly as possible.
More than two-thirds of the country's firefighters are volunteers who hold down day jobs when the fires aren't raging. Leslie McClurg from member station KQED has the story of two of them.
An hour and a half northeast of San Francisco, multiple work crews sever blackened tree limbs at Spanish Flat Mobile Home Villa. Brandon North steps onto a concrete slab that was his home.
Somewhere over here in this concrete pad, there's footprints from my baby brother.
He picks up a warped piece of metal. A cloud of ash settles into the imprints of two tiny feet. About a stone's throw away, Becca Brown Diener steps over a twisted birdcage on her family's property.
This was the spare bedroom, but this was my twin brother's room, but now that's all gone.
She tries to wave away tears. Brandon hugs her. They've been dating since high school.
We would always go over to his house, play board games, and Our families are really close, so we did a lot of movie nights, dinner parties, camping trips.
Now Becca is 23 and Brandon is 25. The young couple live together about 10 minutes up the road. They're campground hosts on Lake Berryessa, and they're trained as firefighters. As a volunteer, Brandon doesn't have to respond to every emergency page he receives, but he always does.
I feel obligated. If you're able to go, you should go. Whether it's small or big, to whoever called, that's the worst day of their life.
Last month, Brandon and Becca were asleep in their small white trailer when a lightning storm exploded in the sky.
I'm terrified of lightning, so I was just kind of videotaping it, and I woke him up, and I was just recording it.
The radio started going crazy. We did have a couple small fires start.
Becca and Brandon headed to the fire station. It was the first time Becca answered a call that wasn't a medical emergency. By the afternoon, the small fires had turned into infernos.
Seeing fire for the first time like that, I was terrified.
Walls of flame, 100 feet high, swept over ridges. Becca jumped on an engine and Brandon headed to the front line. The next day, flames swept down the grassy hill toward Lake Berryessa. Brandon and Becca spent all day and all night cutting back brush and tree limbs and saved the campground. At dawn, they celebrated.
So I was excited because I like fighting fire. But then when it started to get into housing areas and stuff, the excitement went away and more of anger started to set in, I guess.
The next night, he fought the fire at the mobile home park where he and Becca grew up and where their families still live.
It was hard seeing this place burning down and just trying to do my job at the same time. When I came here, everything was fully engulfed.
As white, hot fire incinerated trailers, Brandon helped the few remaining residents to flee. They were people he'd known his whole life. After everyone escaped, he climbed into his truck and called Becca to tell her their family's homes were gone.
My heart broke. I just felt devastated and hopeless. I didn't know what really to do.
And then when I came home, it was kind of safe where our trailer is. Came in, she was sitting there crying, and I was holding her hand and kind of already on a knee. So I was like, well, it's in my pocket.
He's talking about the ring. He grabbed it to make sure it didn't burn.
She's a mess. Might make her feel better.
Like, finally, he asked me to marry him.
He wasn't planning on popping the question, nor did they have time to digest the big news. They continued to fight the fire for 2 more weeks. Brandon says he slept about 8 hours in the first 7 days. Now, they're helping their families resettle outside of California. Becca would love to go, too. But Brandon shakes his head. Not only is this home, but as a firefighter,
I guess a callous way of saying it, this is where the action is, so it's where I want to be.
They hope to celebrate their engagement before the next wildfire strikes California's wine country. For Here and Now, I'm Leslie McClurg.
Well, as we close out this hour, a note to the listeners who may be tuning in for the first time. Many people are listening to live radio more right now because of the news or because the pandemic has changed your listening habits. And if you are tuning in to Here and Now for the first time, we're glad to have you.
Yes, absolutely. Welcome. We're here every day bringing you the latest news with the resources of NPR, the BBC, and reporters in public radio stations from communities throughout the country. We're a team of thousands of journalists working to keep you informed, and we're supported in part by listener donations. So thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.